questions on prior material, anything we've covered so far. What I'm trying to do in the next couple of days is just get a few things out that some people are covering in their papers, just so they get the information they need. So we did the basic asset protection piece yesterday, and what we'll do today is we'll talk a little bit about premarital agreements, a little bit more about some asset protection issues, and then tomorrow what we'll probably do is the education funding piece. And then when we come back next week, we'll do a kind of a brief overview of business succession planning topics, and then some of those special topics, those special need issues like the sudden wealth issues and things like that that we had talked about earlier. Okay, so that's the agenda for the rest of the class. We only have a few more class periods, so summer goes quickly, doesn't it? All right. No questions for me on all that good asset protection stuff we covered yesterday? No? All right, let's talk a little bit about prenups then. And this is the last piece of the asset protection, really, because it deals with making sure that when we have marital combinations, assets are covered in that when people get married. Now, if you think about this from a kind of a personal standpoint, this almost sounds offensive. Some people think that this is a really bad thing to talk about, a really bad thing to say, because of the religious connotations that are tied up with the concept of marriage. Now, marriage, though, from a legal standpoint, is nothing more than a partnership. That's literally all it is. It's a partnership. It's just like a business partnership that you go into with someone else. So if there's going to be a dissolution of that partnership, if you don't have an agreement, the state has default rules that cover that dissolution. If you marry someone and you don't have an agreement, the state has default rules that cover that dissolution. And if you die without a will, same thing happens. The state has default rules that govern the disposition of your property. So all a prenup does, essentially, is it wipes the slate clean and takes away the ability of the state legislators to determine what's going to happen to your property. That's all it does. That's all it's designed to do. Now, if you think about the institution of marriage itself, where we got all the religious connotations, where that started to come in was actually during the Middle Ages. If you go way back, even the term wedding, for example, wedding, people get married, right? Anybody know what the wed is? The wed was an Anglo-Saxon term that meant the consideration provided from the bride's family to the groom's family on consummation of the marriage contract. So it was all a contract. In the old times, marriage was considered a contract. In Ireland, if you go back to the old Briand laws, there were actually 11 different contracts of marriage. 11 different types of marriage, and it was neatly created in a way, because what it did was it prevented any child from being an illegitimate child. That's why they had all these different forms of marriages. So you could get married for a day, for a year and a day. That was the shortest marriage period, and you were deemed to be married for a year and a day if you were going to have a child with someone, so that there wouldn't be an illegitimate birth. So it all goes back to this concept of contract. And we lost that when we started to think more about this as a religious institution or as a spiritual institution. And I'm not trying to dispel that, because I think there's a lot to that. And you've just got to separate what we're talking about here, which is the legal issue, from all those other items. Now, when you look at marriage, there are several things that can cause stress in a marital relationship. And many of you, I'm sure, who have taken the counseling classes, and some of you may even be majoring in the counseling area as opposed to just the pure finance area, you all know what those stresses are. One of the major stresses is finance, is the money. And this can become a big issue when you have people of different money styles marrying each other. If you have a saver marrying a spender, that's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for disaster. If you have somebody that has different views on what money should be used for or how it should be used, that can be a problem as well. And if you look at all the statistics, many of the statistics indicate that one of the major stressors that leads to divorce which is why we have such a high divorce rate in the country, is the financial issue, the financial stress that's caused in that marital relationship. Now, if you think about the process, right, when people start talking about getting married, usually when they start talking about getting married, they're not thinking about money at all, are they? Right? They have other things in mind. They love each other. Everything's wonderful. The world couldn't be a better place. Everything's just perfect, and the flowers are blooming and smell nice, and just everything lines up, right? It's perfect. And that lasts usually about until the wedding and maybe a short time after that. And then reality sets in, and you have all these differences that you never talked about before, and you have all of these conflicts that start to arise. And if you don't have a method of dealing with those, that can lead to problems. Now, if we know that financial stress is one of the major issues in marital disharmony, which we know, the statistics tell us that that's the case, one of the best ways to deal with that would be to address that before the people get married. And that's what a good prenup will do. A prenup is just going to deal with financial issues. Now, I know that there are all kinds of misconceptions about what prenups can do, and some people have done some really strange and crazy things in these prenups and required all kinds of nonsense type performance clauses. John's going to take out the garbage and Sally's going to wash the dishes and stuff like that. No court in the country is going to entertain that. They're not going to look at that and say, we're going to enforce the terms of that agreement if you have that kind of stuff in there. The only thing courts will enforce are financial provisions in an agreement. So all this deals with finances. Now, if you think about how people will act with each other, picture the scenario right before the marriage, within, say, 6 months before the marriage, and how the couple feels about each other then, versus how they feel 10 years later when they're getting divorced. Which position is going to more likely result in a fairer disposition of the property when before, right? You're likely to be more, you're probably going to be much more receptive to being nice to the other party when you feel good about that other party. When it gets to the divorce and both of the parties can't stand each other, which is what happens a lot of times in divorce, I see this, I'm not a divorce lawyer, I don't do that kind of work, but I do see it kind of on a residual basis because several clients have issues with this, and we've had to deal with some of those issues, some of the tax issues in divorce on occasion. And I really have not seen too many amicable divorces. People talk about that, but it really doesn't exist, or at least in my experience, I haven't seen it. So if you're more likely to be fair to the other party before, sounds like that's a good reason to discuss these issues up front as well.
I just have a question about when you do a prenup and like there's a cheating clause in it.
Oh, cheating clause? Okay.
Have you ever heard of that?
Sure.
Where like if one spouse cheats and the other spouse doesn't give anything, like, you just said that only financial things could hold
right.
up in court. Is
right. That- well, if you turn it into a financial penalty, that could be enforced in court. So if anything that you can turn, now that could be something a court would entertain if it, well, when we go through the requirements, you'll see there are limits on this. You can't take it to an extreme where one party winds up being a pauper and the other party winds up getting millions and millions of dollars. That's not going to be enforced by a court because that'll be void against public policy. But you could have, it's not uncommon in an agreement to see almost like a vesting scale with some assets, and you laugh about it, but that's exactly what it is. If, for those of you that have taken retirement planning, it's a vesting scale, and if the marriage lasts this long or this long or this long, X percentage of the assets are considered joint assets, and they'd be equally split. They've had a divorce. So if somebody cheats, then maybe that vesting scale goes away or something like that. Yeah. And that could, well, I guess it could be if you know that a person that you're thinking about marrying has a propensity to do that, right? Especially if you're dealing with all these Hollywood types and those people that hop around from one person to the next every 3 months, it might not be a bad idea to...
Kim Kardashian.
I'm sorry? Kim Kardashian, yeah, she's another good example, right? Yeah. How long did her marriage last? She got married, and I think within 2 months or something, she was divorced. And that's after spending $12 million or some ridiculous sum on a wedding because she wanted to pretend that she was royalty at the time she got married. Is kind of silly in retrospect, but it's, well, I think it's kind of silly to spend that much on a wedding anyway, but that's a personal opinion, not an official opinion. So
I met a planner out of Miami who, one of his clients actually got a prenup null and void because in the state of Florida it is illegal to have sex with someone who's not your spouse and is also a homosexual relationship and not tell your spouse.
Ah, okay.
And that null and void the prenup. It's
okay.
Never existed. In the state of Florida, it is a felony to have sex with someone that is not your spouse, and it's a homosexual relationship.
Okay.
And so it completely destroyed the prenup.
Yeah, and different state laws are going to have different states have different state laws, but there is something called the Uniform Premarital Agreement Act that was adopted by the National Council on the National Commissioners that do these uniform laws. And that was adopted back in 1983, and now most of the states have this. Now, it's called the UPMA for short, Uniform Premarital Agreement Act. And basically what the UPMA says is that if you have an agreement that you enter into before marriage, now this only applies to premarital, it doesn't apply to antenuptial agreements. We have a whole different set of rules that have to apply there. But if it's a premarital agreement, and you're dealing with financial matters, provided that you meet certain requirements, that agreement's going to be enforceable. And those requirements essentially are these. First of all, the agreement has to be something that it was fairly discussed between the parties. And that means that you're going to have a fair amount of lead time before the wedding in order to have a valid prenup. You're not going to be able to have the document at the back of the church and say, before you walk down the aisle, honey, sign this document. Or this isn't going to go forward. If you do something like that, prenup's not going to be valid. So you need some lead time, and usually you want to have, this usually isn't a legal requirement, but usually you want to have separate counsel. Both of the parties should be represented separately. Now you can waive the right to separate counsel and have joint representation, but that's never a good idea. Never a good idea to do that because the attorney cannot serve either party well. If there's joint representation, because there's no way really to best advocate each of the parties' interests. So you want to have separate representation. Now, if you have that length of time, I like to have at least 6 months, but some people will do them shorter. But anyway, you don't want to have the agreement executed at a time when it will create some kind of social pressure to force someone to sign the agreement. So that's why having the agreement at the church doesn't work, because what are most people going to do? If the document's at the back of the church and all the people are there waiting for this ceremony to occur, a lot of people will just say, all right, fine, I'll sign it, because they don't want to stop the proceeding. There'd be a lot there are social issues associated with that. So you need to have a document that's executed far enough in advance. Secondly, the document has to deal with financial matters. That's usually the only thing that the courts will enforce. So if you cover other things like child support or what each party has to do in the marriage and that kind of stuff, courts, that's nice. You can put out whatever you want in there, but no court's going to enforce it. So we want to leave it to the financial matters. And then thirdly, it has to be something that would not violate public policy, wouldn't be void as a matter of public policy. Now, what are we talking about with public policy? Well, the key thing when we look at public policy issues is whether or not one spouse will become a public charge as a result of that prenup. If you enter into a prenup, and because of the way the prenup works, if a divorce occurs or if a separation occurs, one spouse is going to wind up going on welfare and the other one's going to wind up living in the mansion. No court's going to enforce that because it wouldn't make sense. Think about this from a societal standpoint. Why would society permit a private individual to force somebody onto public assistance? We can't do that. It's not in the interest of society, so society wouldn't enforce the contract. So we have those public policy issues that have to be addressed in the agreements. Now, when you set up the agreement, there are some things you can do in these agreements to ensure that they're going to be fair. And let's just think about the typical couple that are going to get married. They want to talk about the prenup. One of them wants to bring up the issue. And more, by the way, this is happening a lot. I used to do these primarily for second marriages. I write a lot of prenups because when you do estate planning, the only way to preserve a lot of the estate planning options is to have the prenup and wipe the slate clean on the state law issues. So these tend to be long documents because you're wiping out all of those things the legislature has put in place, and then you're replacing it with what you think works for you. So a lot of these things are done. In the past, it used to be that they were all second marriages. Now, more and more, I do more of these for first marriages. And there are a couple reasons for that, I think. One, people are getting married later. In the old days, people got married much younger than they do now on average. And then secondly, a lot of times now people are coming with their own property. If you get married right out of school and you don't own anything, there's really nothing to protect, right? You don't have a lot to worry about at that point in time. But if you've accumulated some assets, or you've inherited some assets, or you have, even if you've worked for a few years and you have an unequal amount of wealth, sometimes people are concerned about these issues. So it seems to be becoming more of an acceptable act, I guess. Now, before we get to how to structure them, is there any way you could force your children to have a prenup? Let's say my daughter's getting married. We'll go back to my daughter's situation again, right? We talked about her a few days ago. My daughter's getting married. I want her to get a prenup. How can I force her to do it?
All the assets were trusted. Couldn't you make it a requirement of the distribution or use of the assets?
Okay, that's the game that the wealthy people play. If you have trust in place, it's very, very common to have language in those trust documents, these longer-term type trusts, even short-term trusts like those beneficiary defective trusts that I mentioned a few days ago that you can set up and kind of use as your own little kitty, but you can't take any money out. It gets all that protection. Most of the time when you set those trusts up, you're going to have language in there that says that if the beneficiary gets married and doesn't have a premarital agreement, the independent trustee can't distribute anything to them either. So they'll never get a distribution from those trusts unless they have a premarital agreement that meets these terms. And usually the only terms you put in those kinds of trusts state that the prospective spouse is waiving the right to those assets, to the accumulation on those assets, and would be waiving community property rights as well in the community property state. So they waive all the future growth, essentially, right to all the future growth and the current assets. And when additional assets are put in, so let's say that this is a trust that's currently being funded, the parents are still putting money in, you want to have language in there that says every time somebody puts something in and the beneficiary waives their right or doesn't take the distribution, the premarital agreement should say that the spouse on a prospective basis has consented to the lapse of that right and recognizes that that is not community or joint or marital property, it's separate property. So that protects the assets in that trust from any potential claim going forward. But very, very common clause to have in trust documents for wealthier families. Now, the stats on this, too, are kind of interesting. I used to be a justice of the peace, so I used to get to marry people. And I married people, and I have several clients that have had prenups. Every client I've ever written a prenup for, every single one of them, except the ones that are dead, are still married. Every single one, 100% success ratio on the prenups. Every couple that I married as a justice of the peace is divorce. So that tells you something, I think, a little about these agreements. Now, why might that be the case? What could cause that dichotomy to occur? Well, okay, sure. Some people make rash judgments without really thinking through the consequences, and that's part of it. You in? Oh, okay.
I mean, they talk about the financials. I mean, you just said that earlier, that, you know, most marriages end because they don't talk about their finances.
Right, they didn't talk about it. Right, they didn't talk about it up front.
No.
Right. So, and that causes, and of course, you've got the occasional cheater. Somebody was talking about cheating earlier, and so you get the occasional cheater. I think one of them, you know, within 6 months, the wife was already running around with someone else. So the marriage didn't even last a year, but that was rare. You don't see too many that are quite that quick. But anyway, a large part of that's probably because they didn't talk about the financials. Now, when people are not married, they're single, they're thinking about getting married, these days at least, this may not have been true 30 or 40 years ago, but these days everybody has their own sets of accounts, don't they? So if I was going to get married, my prospective wife has her accounts, she has her bank accounts, her brokerage accounts, her credit card accounts, all of that kind of stuff, and then the husband has his as well. They're all separate. Now, when you get married, a lot of times what people do is they combine all of those things. They take everything and they mash it into one pot, into some kind of joint account. That's a mistake. In my mind, that's a mistake. And this is one of the things that the prenup can fix. What we want to have when we structure a prenup is we want to have each party have their own accounts. So these are their accounts, separate accounts. They keep all those separate. And then when they get married, we will have a joint account. And that joint account will be funded by the parties during the marriage. Now, the joint account presumably would be one that if anything was to happen to the marriage, you'd have a 50-50 split on that joint account. But anything that's kept in separate name and any future growth on those assets would be kept in the separate accounts, and those are not subject to division on divorce. That's the primary thing the prenup does initially. It just separates the separate property from the joint property. So you're creating your own regime, essentially. Instead of just relying on community property or common law marital property rules, you're creating your own set of rules saying, this is how we're going to handle things.
So like you're married and your spouse is a stay-at-home person?
Okay.
And you have a 401k and they get half of it, can you transfer it tax-free, or do you have to pay the taxes on it?
Well, it depends. It depends on how you transfer it. In a case like that, usually if the spouse is a stay-at-home person, you're going to want to have some provision for the spouse in the event that there's a divorce. Because no court's going to enforce this agreement if you get to keep everything. So you're going to have some kind of provision for it to be considered fair. Now, if the 401k is split pursuant to a quadro, you may have spoken about this in your retirement planning class, or maybe even in your estate planning class, qualified domestic relations order, a quadro, the judge in the divorce proceeding can issue that quadro, and that'll split the account. Now, in order for the account to be split, remember, the plan has to permit it. So you may not be able to do that split until the person retires and starts to take the money out, because that may be the triggering point for that particular plan. I think I gave you a story where I have a 81 or 82 year old person that still is working full time because he doesn't want his wife to get any of his pension plan. And the quadro can't split it until he stops, because the plan won't allow any in-service distributions or split of the assets. So he's going to work until she drops dead or he drops dead. That's the way he views it. So one or the other. Might be punishment for himself at a certain point, but that's the way he does it. Now, if the plan allows the split, then the quadro could transfer the assets to the spouse. Now, with the quadro, you're not going to have to pay tax on that. If the spouse, let's say you're getting divorced, your plan gets split, your wife gets half of your plan. She has a choice to make. She can take that, she could roll it to an IRA, she could put it into a qualified plan, If she does that, then there's not going to be any tax on you, not going to be any tax on her. Because all you've done is you've taken the account and kept it in qualified accounts, but now in two different names.
How do you spell that?
QDRO. QDRO, Qualified Domestic Relations Order. That's what that stands for. So you just have two separate accounts. Now, let's say I'm getting divorced, my wife needs the money. My plan's going to be split. She's going to get a distribution. She decides she needs the money. She can take the money. What will the consequence be, though, if she takes the money? She's going to have to pay income tax on that. But there's a special rule here, and this is really important to know in planning, and a lot of divorce lawyers don't know this. I've seen divorce lawyers mess this up with clients in many cases. If she needs the money and she's under 59 and a half, usually if you take a distribution when you're under 59 and a half, what else applies in addition to the tax? The penalty. You have a 10% penalty. But if she's taking the distribution pursuant to a quadro, no matter what her age is, as long as she takes a direct distribution, or he, as the case may be, but if your spouse takes a direct distribution, there's no penalty. So if she needs the money, she wants to take the direct distribution. If you take that money, put it into an IRA first, and then decide 20 days later you need some of that money, it's too late. If you take a distribution from that IRA, now you're going to be hit with both the tax and the penalty. So there is a little bit of upfront planning that needs to be done there to make sure that we're not going to roll over money that somebody might need immediately. Even if they have to pay some tax, we don't want them to have to pay the penalty. So the worst case scenario would be to do the rollover and then take a distribution and wind up paying both. That's even worse for both for that party. So we want to avoid that. So that's how that would work in that situation. Now to go back to this, I just want to, everybody's got the structure. It was separate accounts, which you probably had before marriage. Then we create this joint account. Now, how do we fund this joint account? Well, we can do it in a couple of different ways. Let's say that husband's making $100,000 a year and wife's making $200,000 a year. What we could do is we could come up with some amount that we want to have to go into the joint account. We could say that, all right, well, we'll take 50,000 of this every year, put it in the joint account, and we'll take 100,000 of this every year. Now, if we look at those numbers on a percentage basis, they're equal, right? On a percentage basis, they're equal. But if I hard code those numbers into the agreement, we have exactly the same problem with the prenup that we have in the tax law. And that is that the law or the agreement wouldn't be flexible for changing times, right? What happens if Junior comes along and my wife decides she doesn't want to work anymore? The agreement requires her to put $100,000 into the joint account every year and I only put $50,000 in. Does that sound fair to you? No, it's not fair at all. No court would enforce it. So what you usually do is you use a percentage. Now this could flip too, remember. This might flip, income might flip both ways. So maybe wife keeps making 200 and then husband's business takes off and he's making $1 million a year. If he only has to put in 50,000 and he's making $1 million, but she puts in 100,000 when she's making 200, that's an imbalance as well. So if instead we pick a percentage, we're going to be better off. So the percentage is the first issue. We don't want to hard code dollars. We want to put percentages in. So some percent of each person's income will go into that joint account, which should be used for all of the mutual expenses. And obviously, the higher the income, the lower the percentage we need to have go into that joint account. Because what do we need to fund? We need to fund the costs of the residence, the costs of food, those kinds of things. You don't need necessarily to have $2 million coming into here every year just because you have two high-income people that are married to each other. We only need, even if they're that high income, they probably only need $50,000 or $100,000 to fund joint expenses so that we can have a much lower percentage of income. Now, the other issue that comes up is if I get married and my wife decides to stay home, take care of the kid, obviously that provides a benefit to everybody in the family, right? because those of you that have taken the home economics course know that we're using specialization of labor to maximize utility, right? For those of you who have taken those courses. And a lot of times we'll have one parent stay home because we want to make sure that we give the best opportunity for the child to get the appropriate exposure they need so they can succeed when they get older. That's a good thing. We remember capital. In these types of classes and tax classes, we're always talking about financial capital and how to save your financial capital. But financial capital is only one piece of the pie. You have the human capital, the financial capital, the social capital. All of those things have to be considered. The human capital of the family is a huge asset. So if my wife's not working, what could I do to make this a little bit fairer arrangement? In addition to what I put into here, what could I do? Yeah, you can take part of the earnings when one spouse isn't working because they're rearing children. You take what's left and you split that up so that some of it goes into the separate account. Now, why is this important? This works really well, and it seems to work really, really well with the clients that I've used this with, because none of them wound up being divorced. When we talk about finances in marriage, sometimes you have one partner becoming the economic czar in the marriage, to use the vernacular the government likes to use now. They have all these czars running around. But you have one person who's the czar, and the other person doesn't know anything about the finances. So they don't really, if they want to go to the movies, they have to ask for money to go to the movies. Right? That's not a good thing. We want to have both parties have what I call these play money accounts, these separate accounts. They're play money accounts. What's in my separate account, I can do whatever I want with. I don't care what she says. I can do whatever I want with this. She can't tell me what to do. With this account, she can do whatever she wants with that money. I can't tell her what to do. So what we're doing is we're creating some financial autonomy for both of the parties. And I think that's really, really important in a marital situation, because that avoids that economic czar from being created. In the joint account, this is where you have to agree. But if we don't agree on something being spent out of the joint account and I really want it, what can I do? I can pay for it out of my separate account. So it's not an all or nothing type of proposition. It's one of those scenarios where, yes, it's good. You might want to talk about spending money out of the joint account for something. And maybe I want a sailboat and she wants to redecorate the house and there's only enough money to do one. Well, maybe if we can't agree, I can buy the sailboat from this money. Does that make sense to everybody? How that's structured? So if you set it up this way, you mitigate the opportunity for conflict in the marriage. Now, another thing you do from a legal standpoint, and this is very significant. When you look at these contracts, the premarital agreement is just like any other contract. So normal contract law applies. And with a contract, one way you can always get out of the contract is you can say that you are forced into the contract by duress. Now, the best example of that we've all seen, you've all seen The Godfather, right? And you all know that little story about how The Godfather helped Johnny Fontaine. Right, the Godfather went to meet with all those Hollywood people, and Luca Brasi held a gun to their head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature will be on that contract by the end of the meeting. Right, that's a classic form of duress in a contract situation. So another form of duress is financial. You can force people to do things when you have financial advantages over them. And they could always try and argue, and this always comes up with prenups. If prenups are sought to be enforced in court, the party that's looking to get the bigger part of the gains always says, well, that agreement's void because I signed it under duress. And it was inherently unfair. Now, what this structure does, if you use percentages for putting money into the joint account, and then you also cover this in the event that there's a non-working spouse. But let's just focus on these percentages for the joint account. What this kind of agreement would do is it will, every single year during the marriage, result in a wealth shift from the higher income person to the lower income person. So in the initial example here where we had 200,000 and 100,000, wife's putting in 100 and husband's only putting in 50. But they own this equally. So we have 150 in here. So each party owns 75 if we split this up, right? So what effectively has happened when we fund it that way? We've shifted wealth from the wealthier party to the less wealthy party. When we start to look at contract interpretation in court, courts will look to see whether or not the agreement was unfair by looking to see whether or not the parties were disadvantaged when they entered into the contract or during the operation of the contract. Now, is it going to be possible in this case for the husband to argue? Now, the husband's the lower income person in that example that I just gave you. Is it going to be possible for the husband to argue in this case that he didn't benefit from that contract? No. Every year there was a wealth shift to him. If the wife made more money, every year the husband got part of those earnings allocated to him. So it makes it impossible for them to argue, the other party to argue, that the agreement is unfair or the operation of the agreement is somehow inherently unfair, which a lot of people like to try and do. Okay, do you see how that works? Does that make sense to everybody? It's really a money management agreement. Premarital has a dirty connotation attached to it because of some of the strange things people have done in the past. It's really just a money management agreement for your financial situation before, during, and if necessary, after the marriage. Now, hopefully we never get to that after the marriage issue because we want the marriage to work. But it's just making sure that things work. Not necessarily. It depends.
Okay.
I mean,
it
could depend on the circumstances. It could. These days, it'd be a lot harder to argue that, I think, because there are a lot of people that have children out of wedlock. So, and it's not. It doesn't have the social stigma that it did 100 years ago. So, in the past, that would have been a big thing. In fact, in the past, I mean, if any of you watched the Tudors or any of those older, the Borgias and some of the A&E shows about the kind of the Middle Age period. Well, they're great shows if you ever want to watch them. The Tudors about the life of Henry VIII of England and so on. But anyway, in those shows, they keep on talking about marriage contracts and breaking marriage contracts. And it goes to that issue. If you promise to marry somebody and you break the contract, you actually owe damages. That was an actionable item. And you can go to court and get damages, so you could.
I guess I have a question about like large engagement rings.
Okay.
Like if someone were to, I'm just kidding.
No, these are good questions. I know where you're going. This is a good question.
Well, like if you receive,
yep,
a very large, like, you know, let's say $20,000 $30,000
Yes.
And then got divorced 58 days later.
Is something like it? I mean.
Or better yet, never got married.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, okay. Well, this can get into some of the gift tax issues we talked about. Have you ever heard of somebody paying gift tax or filing a gift tax return when they give an engagement ring to their prospective spouse?
No.
That's because it's not a gift. It's a conditional gift. Legally speaking, it's the engagement ring is a conditional gift, and if the marriage doesn't occur, legally speaking, the lady would have to give the ring back.
What if she doesn't?
The husband or the prospective husband could sue and get it back. So legally speaking, it's not a gift until the marriage occurs. When the marriage occurs, that's when the transfer occurs. Now, why do we want that to happen? Let's say I'm going to get married, I'm going to propose to my girlfriend, and I bought a $100,000 ring for my girlfriend, right? Why do I want that to be a conditional gift until we get married?
Because you can't get a loan of marital
debt. That's right. That's exactly right. That's what's behind the whole thing. It's a tax-related issue. So it's a conditional gift up until the marriage occurs.
How long is a conditional gift, like, conditional for? Like, what if you wait 5 years to get married?
Well, it's conditional if the marriage is called off. Okay. Some people have long engagements. I guess that's fine.
So
right? That's
like
up to them.
Like, the ring belongs to the husband, I guess.
Until the marriage occurs. That's correct.
But if it doesn't occur, then she's probably going to get back.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Now, if the wedding got called off, maybe the husband doesn't care either. So a lot of times in modern times, you don't see people going after, I want my ring, but what's the husband going to do with the ring? Now, it's not like he's going to put it on his finger and wear it around town, right? So, that's where you see issues when the engagement ring is great grandma's engagement ring or something like that. Then obviously it becomes an issue. But the courts have consistently said that that's a conditional gift. And one of the reasons they say that is simply because of the tax rules, the way the tax rules work. Nobody files a gift tax return when they give that ring. So therefore, they can't have departed with dominion and control over that ring. Therefore, it has to be a conditional gift.
Kind of.
No, that's fine. That's what we're here for. Ask the questions. Yep.
Maybe a very large, like, diamond necklace or earrings, like.
Yep.
You know?
That's a big gift.
I'm just really curious, like, you know.
Well, if you have to look at the facts and circumstances.
Okay.
And if the facts and circumstances indicate that it's clearly intended to be a gift, so if he gave you that as a Christmas gift or as a birthday present, or something of that sort, that's probably a gift.
Okay.
And what, right, for gift tax purposes, since you're not married, he could give up to $13,000 worth, but if you go over that, then there's going to have to be allocation of credit or payment of the gift tax.
I guess my question, like, really is, like, how often do people really file a gift on, like, something like that?
Almost never. Almost never. Right. There's the ivory tower, which is what we talk about in the classes, and then there's what happens in the real world. Now, remember, when you're advising clients, you can't advise them to do what everybody else does. You've got to advise them to do what they're supposed to do. And most of the time, they're not going to tell you about this stuff anyway, which is good. But the sad part is, really, in the situation you described, is if somebody's giving you all these necklaces dripping with diamonds and things like that, should they be giving that as a gift? No, that should be in the Crown Jewel Trust, right? They should be buying it inside those dynasty trusts that we talked about before and giving you the right to use it. You should never have that kind of property in your estate because all it does is create problems.
Can you imagine how awkward it would be to tell me if you're giving them the right to use it, not the actual diamonds?
Well,
great.
Well, you just say, honey, I want to treat you just like Queen Elizabeth. I'm going to let you use all this stuff, but you're not going to own any of it. Right? That's what we're doing. That's how we're structuring it. So little gifts are fine. Little thousand, you know, it's a few thousand dollars, who cares about that? But if we're talking about a $100,000 diamond necklace that you wear to the charity ball and those kinds of things, those are items that you don't want to have owned individually.
That's all.
That was all? Okay, good questions, though. Very good questions. Okay, so is everybody comfortable with this structure?
So if he pays, or one of them pays the other because one's a stay-at-home mom.
Right.
Is it a percent or is it half?
Well, it's whatever you agree to.
Okay.
So a lot of times what happens, just to make it easy, a certain percentage goes into this account, and then you split the rest.
So
half of it goes here and half of it goes here. And then that way each spouse has their own financial autonomy so that neither one can really lord over the other one from a financial perspective. And think about how this would work just from a marital dynamics perspective. This should reduce the stress about finances in the marriage, shouldn't it? Because if this person's a spender, he can't stop spending money. As soon as he gets money, it goes out of his pocket. And this one can't bear the thought of letting the money disappear, right? This is the typical accumulator, wants to has the first nickel she ever made. They can say, she can save to her heart's content, he can spend to his heart's content out of their own separate money, and neither one can bother the other. So it gives you a way to deal with two different styles within one marriage.
When they get divorced, he gets part of her savings.
No. No. When they get divorced, this gets split equally.
Okay.
This is hers. This is his. This gets split equally. That's it. That's how it works. Usually, what?
She earned it from taking care of the house, the kids.
Oh, right, right, right. If he was funding it, but she was saving it, well, that was her choice, right? She made a choice to save it as opposed to consume it, so she should be able to get the fruits of that choice.
So does he get to keep his stuff, like say, like he likes a car or a gun?
Yep.
Something like that. He doesn't keep his stuff outside the divorce settlement.
Yep. Anything that's separate property here stays with him. Anything that's separate property here stays with her. And this gets split down the middle, and we're not gonna spend 2 years arguing about these kinds of splits. And when you get to divorce, as hopefully none of you have had to experience this personally, I hope you'll never have to experience this. But I have a client that is he graduated a couple years behind me in high school, so I knew him for a long time. He's getting divorced from his wife, and there are all kinds of problems, and I won't get into that, but she has been dragging it out and dragging it out and dragging it out just to cause problems. And you won't have that kind of situation here. And the way she, well, how does she drag it out? How does she drag the divorce out? She'll go to mediation. They'll agree to some settlement, and the next day she calls up and says, I don't agree to this anymore. And this has been going on for 2.5 years, and they still haven't gotten a divorce. So if you have this in place, we don't have to worry about that. Because as long as the contract's enforceable, she gets half, he gets half, period, the end, we're done, the judge rubber stamps it, it's over. It's very simple. You don't have those kind of long-run divorces. I'm sorry?
Can you have one of these after you get married?
Yes, you can. Now, the problem with an antenuptial agreement, that's what we call an antenuptial agreement, is that when you're already spouses of each other, arguably at least, and I'm going to bring in a dirty word that a lot of people don't like to talk about, and it's flung all around financial planning now, you can almost argue that the spouses are fiduciaries of each other. That when they enter into an agreement, they have to act in the best interest of the other when they're already married. And most states would impose that. The common law, the case law, would indicate that. And some states even statutorily say that spouses have a fiduciary duty to each other. So if that's the case, when you negotiate the agreement, this has to be crystal clear and fair. There's no way to try and move things around in an inappropriate way or try and get a little bit more advantage for you versus your spouse, because you're prohibited from acting in any way that would harm your spouse if you have a fiduciary duty to the spouse. So this is why you want the agreement in place before the marriage. Before the marriage, there's no fiduciary duty between the parties. So the parties can act at arm's length and negotiate the terms of the arrangement. After the marriage, we have a higher standard. So yes, you can have it after the fact. But and you may just want it just for this accounting system, right? I've talked about this a few times in estate planning councils and so on. And some people just like this idea because that way they each have their own financial autonomy, and they don't have to argue about spending $15 at the movie that they want to see, because the other one wants to spend it on something else. It gives you the autonomy. Now what is in these separate accounts? Let's talk about this for a second. Obviously, whatever you come to the marriage with should be in these separate accounts, and that would be separate property. When you earn money during the marriage, the money that you keep goes into the separate accounts. And by the way, we don't want to commingle these. We don't want to mash them all together, because if we mash all those together, then family court judges determine that they have the right to do whatever they want with it because it's a commingled asset and they can't tell which piece of it was separate and which piece was marital. So we want to keep them separate. But any of the separate money would go into those. Question?
What if the property stayed? Like,
That's true.
So how do you keep this separate?
Well, what is community property, though? That's the state default rule. So if I don't like the state default rule, in the premarital, I can wipe that out and create my own set of rules. Yeah. So that all we're doing is we're setting up a system that works better for that couple. And if you think of it that way, if you think of it as money management agreement, where you're trying to substitute your judgment for the judgment of state legislators, and I would venture to guess that your judgment is always going to be better than the judgment of state legislators, right? Then this can work really well. So you can wipe out the community property laws and then create the structure yourself. And in a typical prenup, a very simple prenup, kind of my standard form for a simple prenup is about 28 pages long, because it goes through literally and it wipes out all of the state law preferences and then rebuilds them. So you've got all that legal mumbo jumbo that has to be in there to make this happen, and you're just substituting your judgment for another. Okay, so everybody knows the separate property before and the income that comes in. Anything that you save winds up here. Now, what needs to be specifically included in the agreement? There are some things that are particularly important for individuals like yourselves. One is future appreciation. If you have a prenup that does this, but doesn't address the issue of future appreciation in assets, you run the risk of a judge saying that, yes, you have the separate property, but the income on the separate property was community property in Texas, or marital property in a non-community property state. And since you never took the income from the separate property and put it in the joint account, you commingled the separate accounts, and that means it's all one big pot, and I can do whatever I want with it. So that commingling issue becomes key. Now, it's impossible to completely separate out all the growth. If all you have is our financial assets, it might be easy, because you can take the interest and dividends and you can put them into here. But what if one of the parties has lots of real estate? Can we take the increase in the value of the real estate every year and put it in the joint account? No, we can't do that. But if the value increases, then we have a commingled asset. So how do we fix that? We make sure that the agreement specifically states that all future appreciation on separate property is separate property. The agreement has to specifically state that unambiguously. It has to be very clear. Both parties have to understand that everything in these accounts and all the growth on these accounts are always going to be separate. Okay, so that's the first thing that has to be included in there. Now, there's some esoteric assets too that you need to be concerned with. And this is based on case law. There are a bunch of cases out there that say that, and not necessarily Texas, but they're from all over the country, so these general principles pretty much apply across the country. These cases say essentially that if you obtain a professional degree or a professional certification when you're married, the person to whom you are married at the time you obtain that degree or certification is entitled to a perpetual percentage of your income from that trade or profession. So if you're married and your spouse goes to medical school, and then after he or she graduates from medical school, you divorce, you're entitled to a perpetual portion of their income stream. So how do we fix it? In the prenup, what do we say? We say, what I would usually do is I'd say
dollars for X amount of years, and after that we're
done. Okay, you could do that. But in a lot of cases now, in the old days, you typically saw that. People would get married, and then one of them would go off to school. You don't see that a lot anymore. What do you usually see? People go to school, they get their certifications and degrees, and then they get married, right? So do we want to have those income streams shared perpetually with somebody that might have been my spouse from four marriages ago? No. So we separate those out. And what I usually do is in the agreement, I will list the degrees, all the designations, all the certifications, all of the licenses that people have. And then you say that the parties agree that any additional certifications, degrees, licenses are merely incidental to what has already been obtained. and that they each waive their right to any claim on the income generated by those pieces of property. It's an intangible type of property, but this is important for all of you, especially if you're married now, and you're going to get the CFP, or you're going to become a lawyer or a doctor or an accountant or something like that, then you could have that problem. So that has to be separately stated. Yes?
Can you talk about perpetual income?
Well, what I mean is for the rest of your life.
So, like, they would get a portion of...
your income for the rest of your life. That's... So you could get divorced today, and 50 years from now, that person would still be entitled, according to those cases, that person would still be entitled to part of your income.
Like, how much are we talking about, though?
Well, that depends. It's all up to the judge. And this is the problem when we deal with family courts. There is no standard to apply in a family court. The family court does whatever the judge thinks is fair. So do you want to rely on what some state paid bureaucrat thinks is fair? Do you think what a state paid bureaucrat is going to determine is consistent with what you might want in your circumstances? Probably, and that's all a judge is. A judge is just a bureaucrat paid by the state, right? A lot of them have never been out of, a lot of them never worked, really. They just went from school to the judiciary, just like academics.
So is it either life, or is it the person's life?
Well, as long as the person's still working, the other spouse would be entitled to a percentage of that income stream. Right, well, then they wouldn't.
Then
you know, that it'd expire then.
Okay,
yeah.
Expire then.
Yeah, it'd expire then.
Is this a good enforce in Texas?
Yeah. Yeah, these are most states will enforce these provided you meet those requirements that I went over. That it's fair, that you haven't made one spouse a public charge, you haven't violated some kind of public policy issue, and that the parties had adequate notice and had an opportunity to discuss this in advance. So if you meet those basic requirements, it'd be enforceable. So can you think of any other types of property interests that might need to be separately stated? We have professional designations and degrees. We've got separate property before marriage. Anything else? Let's say you're I'm sorry?
Dogs.
Okay, yes. Actually, you laugh about that, but that's a very...
The news here recently.
Yeah, that's a very, very important thing for a lot of people. A lot of people are more concerned about the dogs and the pets than they are about the money. So if we have, you might want to define that.
Yeah. Take my dog, you have a woman.
Well, for some people, the dogs are the substitutes for kids.
But if you're like
so.
The dog together, and you think, like, I don't know, like if I have a boyfriend and we decide to get married,
yep.
And buy a puppy together, I'm the puppy's mine, but the puppy really loves him more.
Well, yeah, that becomes an interesting issue, and you can let the judge decide in that case. I guess we can bring in a dog expert and see which one the puppy loves more, but have expert testimony on that. But you can define that. Yeah, a dog is a chattel, right? It's a chattel. It's a piece of property. I know that sounds bad, but. But legally speaking, animals are chattel. So you can define that. You can specify the animal as separate property if you'd like to. So, and I think I told you about the Leona Helmsley story, didn't I?
Yeah.
With Trouble, her dog Trouble. I love that. Love that name. Trouble got more than her kids did. So. Yep.
How does that work with common law marriage?
Common law? How does what work? Okay. Oh, okay.
And they're living together for quite some time. Because Texas law, I think it's like 3 months for a common law to be.
Well, right. But in Texas, though, I had a case that dealt with this, so I know this rule. In order for common law marriage to exist, you have to hold yourself out as married. So it's not just enough that you live with someone.
Well, right. Well, like,
you have to publicly hold yourself out as being married.
Like joint account.
That doesn't matter. I can have a joint account with anybody.
Okay,
that doesn't mean I'm married to them. Right? So So if you go to a hotel and sign in as Mr. and Mrs., that's a public, that's enough to create. In fact, in Pennsylvania, there was a case when I taught in the state, and this was in the 90s, so it wasn't that long ago. It's almost, when you hear the facts, you'll probably think it's something that happened back in the 1700s or the 1800s. But what happened was this person was married to a lady, and apparently he had been married to two people at the same time, but then went to a hotel with his girlfriend and signed in as Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and now he was married three times, because under Pennsylvania law, all you have to do is hold yourself out once as being married, and that's enough. That will create a common law marriage. So he went to jail for being married more than once, for bigamy. So it's interesting stuff. But watch out. Now, in my part of the country, it's much different. In Connecticut, you could live with somebody for 1,000 years. You could tell people every day for those 1,000 years that you're married to them, unless there's a certificate in the secretary's, in the local registrar's office, you're not married. There's no such thing as common law marriage. And so that depends on a state-to-state analysis. But if you have a common law marriage, obviously you're not going to have the opportunity to do one of these. So that makes it even worse, right? Common law marriages are... Originally, they were. I think the intent of those was, again, to avoid illegitimacy. But it's kind of outlived its purpose these days. So we should probably get rid of those laws. But a lot of states hold on to them. We have a lot of laws we should get rid of, but we keep holding on to them. All right. Now back to this. And good questions, though. Keep the questions coming. We have the separate property before marriage. We've got licenses and designations and degrees and rights to income streams. What other kinds of things might you want to protect if you were getting married? Okay, inheritances. That's right. And now, normally in a community property state, inheritances are automatically separate property. But in a common law state, it's not that clear. And that can vary from state to state. So that's definitely something we want to specifically mention, that any inheritances and any growth or subsequent growth on those inheritances is going to remain separate property. And since we're talking about inheritances means you got the property because somebody dropped dead. So how else can you get property? Somebody doesn't drop dead. They can give it to you, right? Or you could be the beneficiary of trusts or so on. You might want to specifically state those items and state that the income, the distributions, and so on from gifts and trusts are also separate property. Now, one issue came up at the very beginning of class that hasn't come up again. What's one of the biggest assets most people have a couple big assets. What are they?
Houses and retirement
plans. The house, hopefully, probably will be owned jointly. That'll be in the joint account, probably between the parties. But what about the retirement plans? Do you think a prenup can deal with the retirement plans?
Not really, because isn't that based on the policy?
Because yes.
They have to sign off and agree to waive it if they're going to...
Exactly. A premarital agreement cannot affect rights in a retirement plan directly, because only a spouse under RIA, under the Retirement Equity Act of 1983, only a spouse can waive rights. So if you enter into a premarital agreement, you have all kinds of language in there that says that you each waive rights to the other's pension plans and 401ks and IRAs and all of that kind of stuff. That language is completely ineffective, because at the time you sign the agreement, are you spouses? Nope, you're not spouses. So you'd have to have an agreement after the marriage in order to deal with that. Now, what some people will do is they'll take care of that inside the prenup. They'll say that each of the parties agrees to do those things. And then after the marriage, there might be a requirement that they sign an acknowledgement stating that they're waiving those rights. That's one way, but that's not the best way to handle it.
The house. So like you bring in a house, but you're still making...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so part of it's joint would a part of it be joint, or would it be one of the other buckets?
You could treat it any way you want. You could keep it solely separate and have one party continue to make the payments on it. You could have maybe part of it paid from the joint account, and that creates a little bit of an interest in the other party in the house. It all depends on what you want to do. You can do it any way you want. So, does that answer?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just thinking about like vacation homes that you might inherit.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Well, those are probably, you're probably going to want to keep those as separate, right?
Because if the joint one where you bring into the marriage but it's not paid off is a unique situation.
Right. Right. Now, to get back to the, well, ultimately that's usually what happens, because what you usually find out is the house that you had before and the house that she had before don't meet your requirements. So what do? You sell them and you buy something that does meet your requirements. So that's more typically what happens. But to get back to the retirement plans, can you think of a better way of doing this with a prenup? I could say we intend to waive rights in each other's pension plans, and then I have to rely on my wife to do that after we get married, and she has to rely on me to do that. We're trusting each other to do that. Is there a better way to handle this? Can you think of a way? Given what you know about the basic structure of a prenup, what is enforceable with a prenuptial agreement? What kind of provisions? Financial provisions.
So what if you got a statement that you would cash out your retirement upon retirement and then somehow...
You could do that. You could do that if you wanted to. Now, if you do that, though, you're triggering all kinds of tax liability, right?
Yes.
So that's... you could do that.
Just have a clause in there that refers to any and all income?
You could try that, but that's going to affect rights, so those rights can't be waived until... after the marriage. But how could I structure this? Well, I could put waiver provisions in the agreement, and then I could have a clause in there that says if the waivers are not executed upon request, then the property over here, the 50% ownership interest that each spouse has, is going to change. And the spouse that refuses to waive will lose part of their rights in the marital property. So it changes the percentage. A court will enforce that because it's a financial penalty associated with some action. So you could do that if you wanted to. A better way to do it, though, would be not to... Well, I mean, you could have the provisions in the agreement itself, but a better way to do this... Are you familiar with the differences between the different types of pension plans and the spousal rights and asset protection rights? Kind of. If you have a qualified plan, all qualified plans, no matter what kind of qualified plan you have, qualified plans are subject to RIA, Retirement Equity Act, so the spouse has rights in those plans. Does a spouse have a right to IRAs? If I have an IRA, does my wife have any right to receive distributions from my IRA under federal law? And nobody knows? The answer is no. She has no right to that at all. Now, a lot of times in the IRA custodial agreements that the fund companies have, they'll say that the normal benefit goes to the spouse and they'll make you waive the right. But that's easy. We could just roll it to a custodial account that doesn't say that before we take distributions if we want to. But there is absolutely no right of the spouse to IRA accumulations. So what could I do right before I walk down the aisle when I get married? I can roll over my 401ks and my qualified plans to an IRA, and that solves the problem. If I don't do that and I don't address it in the prenup, when I walk down and I say I do, let's say I have $1 million in my qualified plans, my 401k. As soon as I walk up to the aisle and I say I do, my wife owns half of it. There's nothing I can do about it. And now it's all up to her. If she wants to waive those rights, it's all up to her. I can't force anything. But if I roll it over to an IRA first, and I walk down and say I do, she doesn't get anything. Huh?
Sorry.
Oh, well, it's legitimate planning. It's legitimate planning when this is an issue, if you have large accumulations in these accounts. So that might be something that would be appropriate for a lot of clients, particularly physicians who tend to marry frequently and have most of their assets tied up in retirement accounts. This is kind of standard planning when we look at those types of individuals. Right.
So the asset after they got married would be split.
What do you mean?
Qualified plan. Like if he put more money into the qualified plan after they got married.
I'm not sure.
Well, I would say he takes it from his account and puts it in there instead of from the joint account, the contributions.
Oh, you mean the contributions? Yeah, okay. Usually, if these, I usually think of this as the after pension contribution. Because usually when I write these, we encourage both spouses to contribute the maximum to the qualified plans that they're eligible to partake in. So this amount would be after that's already done. So hopefully both spouses are contributing. But is that what you were getting to? Not exactly. What was it?
Well, you said that it's good planning to roll the money over into an IRA before you get married.
Right.
Okay,
right, but remember there's a difference between contributions and rollovers. For an annual contribution, I can only put $5,000 into an IRA every year. But I could roll over $1 million from a qualified plan to an IRA today.
Well, what I'm asking is, once you are married, would you still contribute to your qualified plan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But
if you got divorced, she would get half of those assets.
Possibly. Possibly, because you could still address it in the agreement and have a financial penalty if there's no waiver. Now, ideally, we don't want to think of this as some planning for the divorce, because that's not what we're really trying to do. Hopefully, the divorce will never come. But if the divorce comes and we have a waiver in the agreement that says that both parties waive the rights to the other pension plans, that's not a distribution from the plan, is it? That's a divorce occurring, and what's the court going to say in that kind of case? They're going to say both parties agreed to waive rights. They're not taking distribution, so RIA doesn't apply. So therefore, there should be no quadro splitting the plans. So you can incorporate language in there that will accomplish that. But IRAs are a good option for you. And Roth, we've talked about Roth IRAs before too. That kind of fits in too for the higher net worth people, because a lot of them have those Roth accumulations anyway. And most of them tend to be in Roth IRAs. And those IRAs are exempt from those marital claims, which is a good thing. Okay. What do you think about this? And this two... Does this go too far? No?
I think before I was against it. Now I think it's...
Yeah, if you limit it to these kinds of things, I think it works. So...
Your dialogue with your spouse is going to have to happen early.
I'm sorry?
Your dialogue with your spouse is going to have to happen early.
Oh, right.
On this, because otherwise it looks...
Right.
Looks like the one that's suggesting it is a money grabber.
Well, that's the traditional perspective. In fact, I have a colleague that had a client one time who had the client was pretty well off, but lived very frugally for his net worth. And he was engaged, was going to get married, and of course we suggested he should have a prenup because he had this level of net worth. And he said, fine, that's no problem, we can have... he didn't. His fiancée was the one that wanted the prenup originally. She came to him and wanted the prenup, but she didn't know what he had. So he said, okay, that's no problem, and then we drafted the prenup, and then got to the financial disclosure stage, because when you do this, by the way, you have to disclose all the financials. You have to give a current balance sheet. When I set these up, at least 3 years of tax returns are disclosed, as well as other financial documents are made available. Usually you put them all on a CD-ROM, put all the credit card statements, all the bank statements, everything on the CD-ROM. Because by giving full disclosure, you're taking away arguments of the other party to say that the agreement was unfair. They had full access to all the information they needed to make. They needed to make a legitimate decision. So usually there's adequate disclosure. So we got to that point where we had the disclosure, and she found out how much money he had, and then decided that she didn't want a prenup anymore. What do you think? Real life case. She wanted the prenup at first, but once she found out what he had, she didn't want the prenup anymore. How many people think they got married? They didn't get married. They didn't get married. It was pretty clear what her focus was at that point. This could take the focus off the money. If this is done right, it takes the focus off the money and lets the people focus on the marriage, which is really what you should be doing if you have a relationship with someone, right? You shouldn't be worried about the money. Let the money take, as you know from all your financial planning classes, money takes care of itself. All you have to do is give it time and cultivate it well, and it'll take care of itself. So focus on the relationship and have the prenup to cover the rest. Yes?
Both parties have to have full disclosure.
Yes. Both parties have to give full disclosure. And what I from a lawyer standpoint, what I would love to have happen is my client gives full disclosure of everything, and the other side tries to hide assets. See, that would be perfect, because then they could never argue out of the agreement. So what were we talking about with asset protection earlier, yesterday? What do we want the asset protection plan to be? Public. Yeah, we do not want secrecy in this. Now that doesn't mean we want to disclose all this financial information so that my prospective spouse can go running around town and bragging about how much money I have or she has, and she has proof of it and all this kind of stuff. That usually you have confidentiality agreements in place before you even give the disclosure, so that there won't be a problem with that release. But yeah, it's. You want to make sure that you have full disclosure.
But if you get a divorce, all that stuff gets filed for your divorce. Now you can seal it, right?
Yeah, you can have it sealed. Okay. Sure.
Depends on who you are, is if they seal it or not.
Well, you can have it sealed, and you can also, if in the divorce the spouse uses that information inappropriately, you can also bring legal action against the spouse for contract violations. So it's not just a tort action anymore. Now it's a contract violation because they violated the confidentiality provisions in the agreement itself. So that gives you a lot stronger enforcement. And it actually ties the hands of the court a lot better, because when we're talking about the family courts, or we're talking even to a certain extent about torts, there's a lot of discretion that courts and judges and juries have. When we're talking about contracts, there's not a lot of discretion there if things are done right. These are the rules. This is how we interpret it. And if A, B, and C line up, there's the result. There's no if, and, or but about it. It's a much more secure area of the law. Okay. Question?
Well, this is a little. I was just thinking about the retirement. Okay, so if you're married, and so they have to get part of it, you know,
right,
legally, and so you divorce, but then you remarry again. Then does your retirement get split?
Oh, it could. It could. Now, what you're talking about is the quadro. Now, if we have the prenup set up right and there's a divorce, there won't be a quadro. There won't be a quadro because both spouses will have waived. Well, they would have waived rights. And when we talk about the waiver that's necessary for RIA, we're talking about spousal waivers. And if in the contract they say they're going to give up their rights to the pension plans and they get divorced, they're no longer spouses. So RIA doesn't apply anymore there. So in a divorce situation, that can be protected. It's when I decide I want to retire and I don't want my normal form of benefit to be a joint and survivor annuity with a 50% survivor. So now I want my wife to waive her rights. Right, that's what we're talking about with the RIA provisions. But in the scenario you gave, if I didn't have any of this to protect, and I got married, and then I got divorced, and there was a quadro, and it split my plan, and it went over to her IRA, and then she gets married again, and then gets divorced again, that IRA could be split, and some of that money could go to her new husband, or her new ex-husband, I guess I should say.
Have you said these prenups kind of supersede state defaults, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the objective,
so,
right.
And that is all states, like it won't change from state to state, like if you get a prenup in Texas, it's good in all the states?
Usually. Because the agreement I use, and I'm from up north, we don't have community property up in New England, but I have all kinds of language in there waiving community property rights and resetting those things as well. So a good or well-drafted prenup should be waiving all of the standard provisions that you typically find under state law, no matter what state you're in, and then you create the system fresh. So that's why the basic, the plain vanilla prenup is 27 pages long, because 27 pages of single spaced small print typing, it's legal type stuff, but that's why it's so long, because you're waiving all of that.
Tom Cruise was married exactly 4 years.
Yes, Katie.
And then Katie's father is a lawyer.
Yep.
And they filed in New York and in California.
Yep.
Why?
Well, that's a divorce issue. I don't know it has something to do with the way the custody arrangements would work with the child, because
they thought New York would be more sympathetic than California,
right?
Because he's a Scientologist,
right? And he has residences in both places, so they filed in both. And then the real issue here is not so much the divorce settlement; it's going to be the child support. Because when you're married to somebody that's making $100 million a year and child support is based on percentage of income, picking the right state to file divorce in could be advantageous, right? So we want to file divorce in the state that's going to have the higher percentage for child support, and that I think that's more the case than anything else.
Why was divorce exactly after 4 years? Oh,
I don't know. It sounds like she was trying to get out for a while, the way they described it. Yeah, she what was when she first married him? I think she was all gaga about him. I guess when she was a kid, she liked him and his movies and so on. So it was in. I guess the reality wasn't quite what she had envisioned. So, yeah, it never is. That's but in that case, it might have been a little bit different when you have all the Scientology stuff going on. I don't know very much about Scientology, but
no one knows much about it.
I thought that you've got a good point, valid point. it's a secretive cult, so. All right. Question?
Would you suggest an antenuptial for a couple that's maybe been married for like 10 years or longer?
If it would...
That's a conversation they want to have.
Yeah, that's probably even harder, actually, than the prenup. Because it's hard to raise that, I think, after you've been doing things a certain way a certain time. But if... Now, let's say the couple's having trouble because of financial reasons. And you can come up with some kind of agreement where those financial stresses can be removed. Sure, that's a great thing to do. Not just for the monetary or asset protection reasons, but to save the marriage. So sometimes you can use it for that purpose. Could be helpful there as well. I told you the stats that I have, right? 100% success ratio for my prenup clients, and 0% success ratio for the clients that I've married. So, not a good track record as a JP, I guess. But
good thing you gave it up.
Yeah. I never really liked doing that stuff anyway, but. All right. Any other questions? All right. That's about all I wanted to cover today. I'm a little tired, I apologize. So I'll let you out early today. We'll come back tomorrow and we'll continue with some of the education funding.